If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, the 4th of November, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today joining me from across the San Francisco Bay and taking a break from numerous TV hits is my colleague, John Yu. John Yu is a visiting fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. John also co-hosts the Hoover Institution's Pacific Century podcast with our colleague, Misha Oslin. John's also an author in his own right. His book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power, is published this summer. John is also an expert on the United States Constitution, the many intricacies and nuances of election law, which is why we're having this conversation just one day after Election Day. John, how are you, my friend?
Oh, good. Probably working on not a lot of sleep, but probably a little more than you.
Well, I don't know. You do TV at all kinds of odd hours since you're on the West Coast and Fox is back and call for that stuff. But I'm glad you agreed to do the show with me because we seem to have reached a new phase in this multi-phased election, John, which yesterday, Tuesday the 3rd, was Election Day in America. And Wednesday, November the 4th, seemed to be Lawyer Day in America. And by that, I mean, the legal teams are now moving after Tuesday's results. You know, it's very funny, John. I've worked on campaigns in my life. I've worked on presidential, Senate, congressional, gubernatorial. And at all times, John, the one thing I've wondered is, what the hell does a legal team on a campaign do? Besides, obviously, compliance laws and just making sure money is maybe clean. But I've always wondered, what do those people do? And today, I think we have our answer. The Trump legal team is scattering around the country, and they're filing lawsuits and taking legal action. John, let's begin the conversation this way. You see what the president's campaign is doing around the country in states like Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. How much of this has teeth and how much of this is for show?
I think there's one place where the litigation really could make a difference, and that's Pennsylvania. Michigan right. and Wisconsin, I don't know whether litigation will really matter in the end, but that's because you've got a lot of the votes counted. I think they're basically 99 or 100% votes counted. Biden has a pretty good lead in both states. It would be unusual, I think, for litigation to be able to turn around, say, a deficit of what, about 20,000 votes in Wisconsin, right. and then was it about maybe 100,000 votes in Michigan. But, you know, Bill, you're right. What do the lawyers do in a campaign? Usually they just sit around, they eat the donuts, they drink the coffee. But that's because everybody forgot about Florida 2000. And so I think what we're going to see possibly, if it turns out that one state still hangs in the balance, and you know better than I the different routes this could happen, but say it's Pennsylvania, then we could have a repeat of Florida 2000, except it's going to be called Pennsylvania 2020.
Yeah, let's just spend a couple minutes here quickly recapping how Florida 2000 went down. You were involved in that process. You did not go down to Florida, correct?
But I think I was there. I went down to Tallahassee twice.
Okay, so you went down there. Just for the audience, just quickly explain how we ended up in a legal fight over Florida. There was a question over the count. I think it was 537 yes. votes or something like that. So
yes.
So exactly how did the courts move in 2000?
So it's interesting. So basically, Florida and its electoral votes were the deciding factor. Without Florida, neither Bush nor Gore could get a majority of the Electoral College. Right. And so the problem was that in several of the counties in Florida, because Florida, like most states, gives the responsibility of conducting the elections and counting the votes to counties, down at that level, there were many ballots which were arguably were not valid because people had not actually chosen a candidate for president. And this was the day of the hanging chad. This was a day when you would punch a hole in the ballot. Some of the ballots, people had not punched a hole all the way through for the president. And they might have just right. made a little dimple, or the chad was hanging and not flew. And then there were arguments that people had made mistakes on the ballots because Ralph Nader also was running for president. And you saw strangely high vote totals for Nader in some of the counties. So the election was already close. and in the range where you would have an automatic recount. That recount, as the original vote did, fell for President Bush. But then the Florida courts intervened, the Florida state courts intervened, and they started to require more recounts. And they started to push the deadline back for the choice of the electors as they thought more and more counties in Florida might have made mistakes in the judge the vote legitimate or the way they count a vote. And it would have gone on, except the U.S. Supreme Court eventually intervened and stopped the Florida courts from ordering more recounts. And so then the original win for George W. Bush was allowed to go forward. Those electors were allowed to be picked, and then their votes could go to Washington, D.C. for the final electoral vote count.
Right. So, John, if there is a case that ends up before the Supreme Court, and we'll talk about that Pennsylvania case in a second. I want you to take me through the nuances of it, though. But we talk about the Supreme Court, we always talk about precedent. So as you hear about this case maybe moving that way, what was the precedent that was set in 2000 by the court?
Yeah, great question. I neglected to mention that. So the grounds on which the Supreme Court intervened in Florida were two. So the one that got the majority, in fact, it got more than five votes, I believe it got seven votes, was the idea that different counties in Florida were using different standards to decide what was a valid vote or not. So say in the states that weren't recounting, the counties in Florida, not the states, that some counties in Florida, you know, they counted their votes, they were done. They did the automatic recount. They're done. They didn't go around, start looking for chads, looking at dimples and so on. The Supreme Court said the voters in those counties might have lost in some ways their right to have an equal vote to the people in the counties that were continuously recounting over and over again, trying to find more votes because the same standard was not applied throughout all of Florida for what was a valid vote or not. Then three justices led by Chief Justice Rehnquist had a separate reason. And this is the reason that has remade its appearance, has shown up on the stage again for the first time in 20 years. In this separate opinion by Chief Justice Rehnquist, he said the Florida legislature set out the standard for what was a vote. And the Florida courts could not intervene and change that standard because under the U.S. Constitution, it is the state legislature specifically, it's not just the state, the Constitution says state legislatures specifically who decide how to select the presidential electors. So Rehnquist said by trying to change the dates, by trying to change the standards for what was a vote and how votes were to be counted, the Florida courts had intruded into the constitutional, the area of constitutional responsibility of the Florida legislature when it passed the election laws. And so Rehnquist said, I would have stopped them on that ground too. That's the rationale that's is making its reappearance now in place, not just in Pennsylvania, but also Wisconsin, Michigan, and North Carolina.
Right. Now, the current Supreme Court, John, has acted on states' voting laws, Pennsylvania, I believe Wisconsin. What did the court do exactly? And has the court made a good situation, bad situation better or a bad situation worse?
It's interesting. I think what the court did politically was wise. Legally, doesn't make much sense to me. And let me explain why. So in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina, courts changed the deadlines or the standards that the state legislature had set for the conduct of the presidential election. So in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court extended the deadline for when votes could get in from Election Day yesterday, November 3rd, to November 6th, essentially extended the date of Election Day by 3 days. In Wisconsin, a federal judge tried to do something similar, tried to change the date that the state legislature had set. North Carolina, something similar. Now, the weird thing is, in the Pennsylvania case, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't do anything. It didn't strike down what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did. It didn't uphold what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did. It said, we're just going to wait. In Wisconsin, a lower federal court struck down that effort by the judge to change the date. And the U.S. Supreme Court upheld that and said, yes, it was wrong for a judge, here a federal judge, to intervene in the Wisconsin elections and change the date when the ballots were due and to be counted by. And then in North Carolina, where it, again, this was in North Carolina, it was in the state courts, the Supreme Court, again, like in Pennsylvania, we're going to wait, we're not going to intervene. The only difference, the legal issue in all three cases was the same. Can courts step in and change the dates and the manner of the elections that had been set by the legislature under their federal constitutional right to control presidential elections? The only difference, as far as anyone can tell, and Chief Justice Roberts wrote an opinion admitting that this was the only reason he was voting with the liberals in the Wisconsin and North Carolina cases. The Pennsylvania and North Carolina cases, but not the Wisconsin case was, well, the Wisconsin case came out of federal courts below. Pennsylvania and North Carolina came out of the state courts below. This drove the four conservative justices bonkers. So Thomas, Alito, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch all have signed opinions saying that the constitutional issue, the same one that was in Florida 2000, has reappeared and that the Supreme Court should hear it and should decide it. And Justice Alito even went as far, Justice Alito is from New Jersey. He's the justice who's what we call the circuit justice for Pennsylvania. He basically went out and wrote an opinion saying, I think what the Pennsylvania courts have done here is unconstitutional and they don't have the authority to change the date of the election, essentially from November 3rd to November 6th.
Right. Okay. So what you're telling me is the court basically left Pennsylvania like that dangling Chad dangling out there. And so now they have a chance to address it again. We should preface this by saying this. We're here, we're talking on a Wednesday, 8 o'clock California time. Arizona is still not settled. Nevada is still not settled. If Arizona is confirmed for Biden, if he picks up Nevada, it's over. He's at 270. So Pennsylvania is moot, but it's a big but strange things happen involving Donald Trump in politics. And so if somehow Biden does not get to 270, then we're in the situation it's Pennsylvania. So let's talk about that. It's John U country, by the way. Philadelphia is at the heart of this. The case in question, John, is Republic Party of Pennsylvania v. Bookvar, in this case being Catherine Bookvar, who is the embattled Secretary of State for that state. Tell us what Republican Party of Pennsylvania versus Bookvar is all about.
Yeah. And, let me say I've, talked to people involved with the Trump campaign about all these things and have talked to friends in Pennsylvania about all these things, not telling them anything. I'm telling you the same thing because it's all set out in the Constitution and the laws. So this case out of Pennsylvania. Yeah. So assume Trump wins either Nevada and Arizona and Georgia, North Carolina get called for him.
So let's assume Pennsylvania is on, John. So let's do two things. Let's number one, let's talk about what is at issue in the case. Then secondly, how mechanically the case proceeds.
Yeah. So what's at issue in the case again is the state legislature in Pennsylvania. They did change the rules for the election to reflect the demands of COVID. For example, they made it extremely easy in Pennsylvania to do a mail-in ballot. That was the big change. If you go back and look 4 years ago in 2016, I think I looked this up. I think this is right. Only 84,000 people in the state sent in a mail-in ballot. Pennsylvania is one of those states that where you have to show reason why you should be able to mail in your ballot. They changed that so that people could generally do mail-in because of the epidemic. And so in the primaries in 2020, for example, there were 1.5 million mail-in ballots. So you're talking about two orders of magnitude. I mean, it's a huge change. So the legislature did that. But what the legislature did not do is change the date by which they actually did change the dates to a more favorable date. It used to be the absentee ballots had to come in earlier than election day, but they said the ballots have to be here by November 3rd to be counted. Mm-hmm. Now what happened is actually the litigation was actually brought by the Democratic Party originally against the Secretary of State, almost like it's what we call collusive litigation. These are not people who generally are in disagreement because Bookvar is appointed as a Democrat. So they sued, and they said they wanted the date to be changed. Actually, they pushed for it to be 7 days. They said any ballot that comes in within 7 days after November 3rd should be counted. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court split the difference and said, we will extend it to November 6th. Mm-hmm. Then the Republican Party of Pennsylvania came in and appealed that and said to the, and went to the U.S. Supreme Court and said, this violates our constitutional right under the federal constitution to set the rules for elections and to govern how the electors for the presidential election chosen. Pennsylvania Supreme Court says, well, yes, you do have that right, but there's a clause in the Pennsylvania Constitution that says there must be basically free and fair elections, and it would violate the free and fair elections if people cast a vote and it just didn't get there on time because of the post office or because of the epidemic. And so we're going to change the date anyway. That's the constitutional question that's up. It's sitting there right now. It's on the docket of the Supreme Court for them to decide whether they want to hear the case or they just want to reject it and let the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision stand.
Okay. Well, let me put you on the spot there. What do you think is going to happen?
I think it really depends on your part of the equation, Bill, because I don't think the Supreme Court will do anything unless it matters.
Right. So Biden's a 270 without.
Then they'll reject it. Because, okay. And I don't think people in Pennsylvania will care that much either, because their vote won't change who's president.
John, they would not want to step in and just do this again for precedent, so we don't go through this again in 2024.
God, you wish they would. I mean, there is something to be said for it might actually be good for them to step into Pennsylvania, decide this, even because it doesn't matter, because then you know all they're doing is making the rule clear and not trying to affect the election. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the way John Roberts thinks. And, you know, John Roberts has been the key vote. He was the one who did not vote with the four conservative justices, depriving them of the fifth vote to take the case. Right. And a lot of people speculate, I think the speculation is correct, is that he doesn't want the court to be in the position it was 20 years ago when people could accuse the Roberts court now rather than the Rehnquist court of intervening and effectively picking the president and all, you know, the three Trump judges plus, you know, the three Bush judges combining to hand the election to a Republican nominee. So I think Roberts just wants to try to shrink into the smallest profile possible so no one sees him or the Supreme Court at all as an actor in this drama.
And that would speak to not taking the case, because if you take the case, John, you have to pick a side.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I did a little internet research for this podcast, John. You know what I discovered?
Uh-oh.
Richard Nixon was in a very similar situation in 1960. There's a narrative that Richard Nixon loses the election and he looks at the results and he knows that something has been going on in the way of voting shenanigans, but for the good of the country, he gracefully steps aside and the rest is history as we know it. But actually, there's more to the story here, John. Just to recap a little bit about 1960, Nixon loses the popular vote to John Kennedy by about 113,000 votes out of about 68 million cast. So we're dealing with 68 million votes. I mean, this is small potatoes compared to what we have in this election, what, 155 million votes or so, maybe. Illinois, Kennedy wins Illinois by 9,000 votes. John, Texas, John Kennedy wins Texas, John, by 46,000 votes out of 2.3 million cast. And if you look, especially in Texas, I saw there's one district where they had only like 150 registered voters, and Kennedy got 187 votes to Nixon's 37 or something like that. So clearly,
it must have been LBJ's district. He's still sitting on those votes he stole in his election to the House.
1948, yeah. But it kind of has an eerie parallel. That's why I mentioned this. Right now, you hear, you know, Trump supporters, for example, complaining a couple places in Michigan that are very conservative. Suddenly, their votes look very Biden, so they don't know what's going on. Anyway, this is what Nixon was looking at in 1960, John. He had only 219 electoral votes. He challenged Illinois and Texas, the two most obvious spots where mischief was going on. He gets 51 electoral votes out of those two states. He's at 270. And here's what happened, actually. 3 days after the election, John, the Republican National Committee chair announced proceedings to question the results in Illinois and Texas and nine other states. In fact, John, there was actually, in effect, there was a Nixon recount committee, actually, in Illinois. But here's the difference then and now. Nixon, John, never put his fingerprints on these legal efforts to go in and revisit the votes. Actually, Illinois did actually do a recount on its votes in Cook County, and the numbers still came out to Kennedy's favor. But the point is, Nixon did not actually, he didn't do what Trump did on Tuesday night. He didn't go up in front of the cameras and go off in true Trump Ford. He kept his fingerprints off because Nixon was saving his powder for another day, which is a smart move. But here you have Trump in the middle of it. This is a long way of saying, John, that actually this is nothing new to American politics. While it is, you know, unique with Trump to be in this legal situation, and this does have echoes of 2000, we've been plagued by legal problems for, you know, multiple elections.
Well, 2 points. One about your Nixon point is, and we will talk about this later, is that Nixon also would have been the vice president who opened electoral votes when they were counted in the Congress. And if there were a challenge to be made about the legitimacy of those votes, they would have been made to Nixon initially. And he could have, and Gore could have done this in Florida 2002 as both the sitting vice president and the candidate for president to succeed the sitting one. They could have made a ruling in their own favor at that point. And I think Nixon doesn't get enough credit. Both he and Gore, and I don't think Gore gets enough credit, they did not use their position as the sitting vice president to manipulate the workings of the counting of the electoral votes, but they could have easily. And you could see that, you know, you could see that happen in this election. But the second thing, you're right, Bill, I think that the lawyer, and this goes to your, the way you started out the show, what the hell are the lawyers doing here? It's an election, for Christ's sake. But the reason the law gets involved is because America can't make its damn mind up, right? When the elections are close, like 2000 and now, and that's when law makes a difference. And generally, as you say, you know, in 1960, maybe law could have made somewhat of a difference, but back then people didn't think they ought to litigate every nook and cranny of the constitutional procedures because they could see the nationwide majority vote went from one side or the other side, and they decide to respect that rather than pushing their legal rights.
Are you suggesting in a society that's fond of litigation, John, that elections have become an extension of our penchant to want to go to court and sue?
You know, it's always a good idea to be on the same side as Tocqueville. Tocqueville said, right? He said, sooner or later, and he did notice that, right? He noticed America is a litigious culture. And he actually traced it, unfortunately, to the position lawyers play in society, because he said there's no aristocracy in America and lawyers replaced their role. And he said sooner or later, every important political question turns into a legal question in America.
Right. Good point. True or false, John, in Arizona, any voter in Arizona can contest an election result in state court.
Is that right?
It is true.
I could see that.
It's true. Among the grounds for challenging an election result are that, quote, illegal votes were cast or the tabulation errors led to the wrong candidate being declared the winner. So this gets to the question of standing. So if you are a diehard Trump supporter and you're convinced the fix was in, can't Trump people just go to court left and right in all of these states and try? It sounds like a Hail Mary, I guess, but couldn't you just file lawsuits and just hope that something strikes?
Yeah, and it goes to your question. Actually, I didn't answer it. In your earlier question, one of them was, what happened to Bush versus Gore? Right? Yes. What did it set a precedent for the future? It never did. You don't see, the Supreme Court's never revisited Bush versus Gore, has never applied it. But people at the time made the same observation, I think, that you're making now, which is, if the idea of Bush versus Gore was that you have to use the same standard to count the votes throughout a state, and if one county uses one and another county uses a different one, that state has violated the Bill of Rights, violated the equal right to vote, then that means that, yes, any individual voter and the candidates, too, should be able to bring lawsuits saying somehow the state counted votes in a strange way and it, say, discounted my vote and it overcounted somewhere else. And that's a violation of my right to vote because each vote is not equal anymore. And so, yeah, Bill, I think you're right. I think even if Arizona law didn't provide for it, I think any voter under Bush versus Gore has this right to file a lawsuit and challenge the way the vote count was done. And that's certainly also in addition to the separation of powers about the state legislature versus their courts. That's also another suit you could bring in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania and Arizona on the behalf of the Trump campaign.
Okay, so as you look at these suits right now, John, you mentioned the Bookvar case in Pennsylvania. Is there anything else that's caught your eye, or do you think this is just all about Pennsylvania at this
point? I think it's going to be about Pennsylvania. So Wisconsin and Michigan, you don't have that claim. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, in Wisconsin, The courts actually, in the end, struck down efforts to change the dates and the procedures in the same way that happened in Pennsylvania. So I think
John, isn't legal prodding in those states, isn't that about observing votes, about making sure that votes have been counted?
The lawsuits in Wisconsin, Michigan are going to be more about like the Bush versus Gore kind of suit. Are you carrying out the procedures? Are you counting the votes in the same way? Did you do the recount right? And you know more than I about the margins that can change and recounts and so on. But I've been told that you really recounts don't have an effect of shifting 20 to 80,000 votes in a state.
Wisconsin's pretty good at recounts, and it's a 20,000 vote margin. So that's a big chunk of change. But I'm curious about the mechanics here, John. So we go back to 2000 in Florida. It's very clear what happens when the court rules the way it does. That's it. We stop at this point. We're not going to keep counting votes. We're going to decide that's the tally and George W. Bush wins Florida. But this is a big what if. But what if this case actually went before the Supreme Court, Pennsylvania hangs in the balance, and a 5-4 court rules in favor of the Republican Party of Pennsylvania? Then what happens to the vote count, John?
That's really interesting. There's the legal, and then there's the counting of the votes, which will come after in Washington. But initially, what would happen is that the rule would have to switch back to what it was before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court intervened. And the rule as it was before was mail-in votes are counted as long as they're received by November 3rd. Now, one thing that Pennsylvania did here in the litigation to try to comfort the justices was to say that we will segregate all the ballots that come in under our new rule. So all the ballots that come in between November 3rd and November 6th, this extra 3 days that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania ordered, we'll hold those separate. So if the Supreme Court eventually says, no, you were wrong, go back to the original rule, then all those ballots were kept apart and won't be counted. Now, if that's the case, then you can say, right, you'll have a vote certain then ordered by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is right, just all the in-person votes on November 3rd, including my mom, I might add, who voted in Pennsylvania. And she waited in line for hours, she told me. Uh-huh. And the mail-in ballots that came in by November 3rd. And that's it.
Right. Let's talk about the Biden campaign, John, and what the Biden legal team is doing at this point. I assume they're doing more things than just looking at the plum book and trying to figure out what appointments they're going to get in Washington. But for all we talked about the Republican Party of Pennsylvania and Trump's campaign moving, how is the Trump campaign legally, the Biden campaign, how are they legally set up at this point?
So what they're going to do is they're going to try to intervene in all these states too, where Trump is filing, right? They don't have to file in other places, although I guess they could file in places like Georgia and North Carolina, right, where the Trump advantage is really close. And they might be able to argue that there's something funny going on in the vote counting, although you don't see many press reports that suggest that anything's happened that's funny in those places yet. But say in Michigan and Wisconsin, or even Pennsylvania, they could try to intervene in these suits and defend what the states have done. And say, for example, with the 3 extra days in Pennsylvania, they could come in and say, look, these are votes that were cast, and every vote that's cast should be counted. And this was essentially the argument that Gore made in Florida in 2000. The votes have been cast. Maybe they don't necessarily meet every single jot and tittle of the rules, but the overall constitutional principle is that we should count every vote. We should give intent to the voter. We should honor the voter's intent. And so, yes, maybe there are these ballots that came in for 3 weeks, but it's not their fault. It was the Postal Service's fault, or something happened. But the voter tried to meet the rule as they were instructed on the day of the election, which is they had till November 3rd to get it in, and anything after that was somebody else's fault, like the post office, but they didn't do anything wrong. And so we should recognize their constitutional right to vote. That's a very good argument. It's a good argument because it resonates both politically and legally.
Is there a constitutional right to vote, John?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not actually, right? I mean, the vote, it's been
the Bill of Rights, thou shalt vote.
There you go again, Bill, screwing everything up by reading the constitutional text on your own. No, it's really, it really comes out. I mean, this comes out of the 60s, of course, in the one man, one vote case, Reynolds versus Sims.
That's why I'm asking, because you hear this phrase, it's your right, constitutional right to vote. Yeah,
it comes out of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, and it's the court has inferred that you have the equal right to vote. Yeah, you're quite right.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. So this is kind of at the end of the day, this is kind of the problem facing the court, the conundrum, if you will, is just, does every vote count or not?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And so there's always been this balance that the court has tried to strike in its election cases. As you, on the one hand, your right to vote. On the other hand, the court has also said states have a legitimate interest in having an orderly election. Right. Like they said, like, I can't just drive over to Pennsylvania and say, oh, I'm changing my residence and I want to vote on November 5th. I used to live in Pennsylvania. So why can't I vote? Right. So the court has said, look, obviously, you have to have a system where you draw lines. That's like election day itself. In fact, Kavanaugh's opinion making this clear. It's interesting. Justice Kavanaugh's opinion said, the reason we have to reject Wisconsin's change of the date, and he actually said and implied that, you know, the reason we have to change, you know, intervene in Pennsylvania, although he didn't say this clearly, is even choosing an election day is, you know, a limitation on the right to vote. You're saying, you know, if you showed up a day early or a day late, your vote doesn't get to count. You have to show up on this day. But he said, you know, the court has always said there's an interest in the states to have a regularly orderly election. And sometimes you have to draw rules about what's a legitimate, valid vote and what's not in order to do that.
The states, John, have put us in some pretty interesting places. I have a couple of friends who live here in Palo Alto near me. I won't name their names, but
they may not be friends much longer.
More the point, I'll be in court with them. No, be asking you for legal advice. They've been spending time in North Carolina, is where family is for them, and they because of COVID they could work virtually, and actually they both voted in North Carolina. What they told me is it's very easy to vote in North Carolina. Basically the state just asks you if you intend to be a North Carolinian at some point.
Yes.
And if you say yes, come on down.
Yes. Yeah. So you can change your residence. Now, I think the California Franchise Tax Board is going to be very interested in these activities. But look, you can each state, you know, you can change your residence. And if you change your residence, you can change your place you vote, but you can't do it fraudulently.
But it's interesting because I don't think they're quite doing fraud, but what they're saying is I'm splitting my time between North Carolina and California, and I'd rather in my heart, you know, it's James Taylor, I'm in California, I'm North going to Carolina in my mind, they're saying that I want to identify North Carolina, and the state says fine, okay, vote, but they're also not checking really how many days you're in North Carolina, if you really are a resident, if you have maybe you have to check on property, maybe I need to dig more in this. And anyway, it's really
you have to spend I think a certain number of days in the state.
Yes, and the Franchise Tax Board in California can tell you exactly how many.
Exactly, 183 and a half days, I believe.
Well, but we have this crazy quilt across America now of all these states that are different voting standards, and the federal courts, the federal government cannot compel the states to do things uniformly, right?
This is interesting, Bill. This is actually the beauty of our federal beauty or, you know, burden of our federal system of government. You know, you talk to people in other countries, they think this is insane, right? How why do you even let states run the elections? They're for federal offices. And this is something our founders actually spent a lot of time arguing about, because they were really worried. They were a little paranoid about the federal government. And so they didn't want the federal government to control how elections were run. So in our system, unlike other parts of the world, the states, it's a really interesting thing about it, the states run the elections for the choice of officers for a different government, right? The officers of the federal government, which just seems very strange. So that's right. But I just want to make clear, under the Constitution, the Congress can overrule the states as to the time, place, and manner. But this is interesting, of only the elections of the Congress. They don't have the power to overrule the state legislatures as to the presidential election. So you're quite right. But when it comes to electing the president, that is only up to the state legislatures. They decide. Every state has given that to the people, right, has had popular election. But until the Civil War, there were still states that the legislature would just pick the presidential electors, and they wouldn't let the people vote on the presidency.
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, you'd like to see all the states play by the same rules. On the other hand, the states are different in their characters and their makeup. You know, we're waiting for Nevada votes to come in, and we don't know if the votes are coming in from Clark County, which is, of course, your Las Vegas, John, or if it's, you know, somewhere out in the great, you know, out in the desert somewhere, where it takes people days maybe to get to turn in their votes. Who knows? But so states have different characters. Hey, I'd like to divert for a second and ask you a question about our friend Mitch McConnell, John. You've been on podcasts. We've had a lot of wonderful time in the past couple of months talking about what ifs, and one of the great what ifs that we talked about was the Supreme Court, the idea of the filibuster and packing the court with more judges. And it appeared at this hour that the Republicans are going to maintain control of the Senate, which means that ain't going to happen, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, you're not going to have the filibuster see an early death. And without getting rid of the filibuster, I don't see how, even if the Democrats control the House and the presidency, they're going to be able to pack the court or add two new states to the union. So I think that was, and I wonder, you tell me, I wonder whether there were people who split tickets, who vote, for example, Maine. I saw Susan Collins won, which she was like the most endangered species in the Senate, as people were saying, along with Cory Gardner and Martha McSally. But I assume people split their ticket in Maine. And I wonder whether people thought,
no, it's a great question.
I like Biden to beat, but I also want then the Republicans to control the Senate.
You raise a great point. Your intrepid host spent some time doing some homework on Senate presidential races. And if you go back to 2012, John, what you find is about 90% of Senate races toe the presidential line. In other words, you vote for the Democrat, you vote for the Democratic candidate for Senate. So that tells you that there's a 1 in 10 break in these in these things. And so Susan Collins may be that 1 in 10 break where she comes through in Maine. Maine's a very complicated state, though, John, in addition to the independent streak. it's a really funky state. They also had second rank. They have a ranked choice voting. That's a huge bullet dodged. If that had gone another round in the ranked choice, she may not be with us. And she just kind of worked her fanny off. And it kind of shows you the great disconnect in this election, where she was just declared dead on arrival going into this thing because of her Kavanaugh vote, not because of the Amy Coney Barrett no vote, though some people thought that just kind of reinforced her bad position because it just raised the whole bad feelings over Kavanaugh. But she went back there and she campaigned very hard, and there just weren't, you know, coattails to bring over. So she was kind of that anomaly sticking out. But I've been thinking about McConnell in this regard, John. So the Democrats threw tens of millions of dollars at him, as they do every 6 years, to try to kick him out of office. And as happens every 6 years, he was reelected. He's been in the Senate since 1985, so this is a very familiar theme by now. So he comes back, John, and he's kind of like the guy who's been pardoned by the governor here. He is he is still the majority leader, we think. And he, you know, he can kind of do things by his own rules. And here's what I think about, John, today. Could McConnell go into the Senate next year and say that, you know, I've been thinking about what Harry Reid did on judges years ago, and it was a terrible idea. So we're going to undo that. So we're going to go back to
being able to put the filibuster back on judges.
Remember Frank Costanza and Seinfeld, I'm back, baby. It's,
you know, Seinfeld's my favorite show. So
yes, but could he act? Yes. I mean, I guess it's a legal question. First of all, could McConnell actually, we'll get to the temerity side of it in a moment, but could McConnell actually do that with a straight face, saying that, you know, this is part of the problem here, that we did this with the filibuster, so we're going to be able to filibuster judges now. Ha. Huh.
Yeah. Well, first, as a constitutional matter, he could definitely do it, because a filibuster is just a Senate rule. And the Senate, the odd thing is about the filibuster is that it takes a majority to put it into place and to remove it. So it's an odd thing where a majority willingly gives up its power by saying, we will allow a small minority stop us from doing what we have the votes to do. So he could certainly do that. And I think he would also, and this now goes into the politics of it, you know, he could say, look, I was against removing the filibuster for judges back when Reid did it. And I only extended that to Supreme Court justices as a retaliation. And now we've seen the harm it does to each other. But I don't, so I'm going to reinstate it. But it doesn't have any more effect as long as Mitch McConnell and the Republicans control the Senate. Because I have no doubt that if the Democrats say they take the Senate in 2022, that they would then, and they have, say, Joe Biden as president, they could use their power as the majority in the Senate to just repeal the filibuster again.
Right. It just came to mind in terms of, you know, we don't know what mood McConnell's going to be when he comes in next year, but you just might think that, you know, I'm not happy with the situation with the Democratic president. I think our guy got a raw deal here. I don't like the fact that they put a big bullseye on my back yet again. And so, you know, it's payback time. And, you know, Chuck Schumer threatened payback, so I'm going to give you some payback. And doing that filibuster is kind of like extending a very big, giant middle finger at them, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, the other thing he could do, I mean, you know, he enacted a whole bunch of changes in the Senate to accelerate the confirmation of not just you know, he's not been just good for Supreme Court justice, but the lower courts. He has really accelerated the pace. And so he could also undo all those changes, too, and say, oh, no, we need to have a lot of time to debate each judge who's nominated by the Biden administration. And we're going to go back to a more leisurely schedule for considering hearings. So he could, you know, reintroduce a little more luxury and comfort in the Senate's consideration of judges. He could certainly do that.
That's what I wanted to ask you, John, just kind of what balance you thought would be. Let's assume it's a Republican Senate. Let's assume it's a similar setup to what it is right now with Republican-controlled judiciary. How often do you think they would just flat out shoot down Democratic nominees versus, as you just alluded to, slow walking them through the process?
Yes, I had the, you know, the honor and pleasure to work in a similar situation. So I was, you know, the general counsel of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. When it was Republicans and Bill Clinton was president. And so it was always their view in the Senate. And maybe it's different now, maybe because times are maybe even between now and then have become even more partisan. But the Republicans in the Senate, it was their view that they really shouldn't go around just shooting down nominees. The president still had the right to choose them. What they could do is maybe try to cabin the kind of people that Clinton was going to pick. So that they were more moderate, and that if they could convince the president to pick more moderate nominees, then they would try to, you know, put them through expeditiously. But if that Clinton picked outliers, people who are just really outside what the Republicans thought was the mainstream, that they would still try to put up a fight for them. But they didn't really vote down that many. They're very, very few. In fact, what they ended up doing was just, as you said, slowing down people who they really thought were outside that mainstream while, you know, trying to work out deals, trying to come to compromises on nominees. Now, things are so partisan now, it might be the case that a Biden administration just wouldn't try to strike deals, although Joe Biden would. I mean, Joe Biden was, you know, in the Senate for decades and decades. He was the chair of the Judiciary Committee himself, and he was the minority ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. So he would, and I think Clinton eventually did this, he would see the virtues of just striking a deal so he could just speed up his own nominees getting on, even though they might not be as liberal as he and the progressive wing of his party might like.
Yeah, I'm just curious because Senate Republicans just don't historically play blood sport the way Senate Democrats do when it comes to judicial picks. You don't see, you know, just the nasty characterization.
Yeah, we don't go after their personal characteristics or their backgrounds. We just fight on their what we think their votes are going to be like, their thinking. Yeah,
no, you know, maybe it's a reflection of how the parties operate, because I'm not sure the conservative base gets all riled up as does the Democratic base when it comes to judges. But I'm just kind of curious as to what kind of flashpoint that might be if there is a Democratic president for them to be working with.
Yeah, I think to compare to what happened under Clinton versus the Republican Senate, there were at the very beginning of the Clinton years, there were a few judges who Clinton nominated. And this was actually at a time when the Republicans were in the minority in the beginning. And then you might remember they won the Senate 2 years later in 94. So from 92 to 94, what happened was basically the Republican minority organized and tried to vote uniformly against some of the most liberal lower court nominees. At the same time, they said Ruth Bader Ginsburg, great. She's in the mainstream. We love her. And she had enormous Republican support in the Senate. But you might have gone back and seen there were some very high opposition. There was some high opposition to some of the early nominees. For example, there was, I think, a judge in Florida who had, as a Florida Supreme Court justice, she had voted often against the death penalty. And that sent a signal, because once they came into the majority, Clinton didn't want to have that fight. And this is an interesting call Clinton made. I don't know if Biden would make the same call. Clinton wanted to get reelected. He did not want to have political fights with the Senate over left-wing judges. Right? He just didn't want that as a political issue for Bob Dole. So he eventually started nominating more and more moderate judges. And the Republicans in the Senate said, okay, we're going to cooperate on those guys. And so they reached a kind of accommodation. And maybe that's what would happen eventually with Biden. Maybe, I don't know. I Biden, I don't know whether now that he's president, if he wins, he'll say, gosh, I really do want to be reelected. I don't want to be a one-termer. And if he doesn't want to be a one-termer, then maybe he's going to strike deals with McConnell's. That's what I would do. That's what Clinton did.
That's an interesting point. We'll have to see how it plays out. If he intends to be a two-term president, if he is president, if he intends to be a two-term president or not, and where, if he wants to be a moderate, where he makes his stands. I just think if he wants to do it on judges, boy, that's a very hard hill to take, because it'll be a lot of pressure to go minority, to go very woke, to make statements, if you will. Let's get back to the legal ramifications of the election, John. Back in 2000, you had very big dogs involved in legal fight. Yeah, Jim Baker, James Baker, David Boyce on the Democratic side. Are there big dogs now? I see a lot of smaller pooches kind of scrambling around, male and female, sort of sexist comment, but just no big, large figure like a James Baker. My God, Secretary of State James Baker is a big deal coming to here. David Boyce is a very big time lawyer. I don't see that kind of caliber person yet, though, or could I?
No, I think that's still to come, Bill. I think both sides are aware of this, which is, of course, they're waiting to see whether a state like Pennsylvania matters, right? So, if Pennsylvania does matter, then I think you will see both sides. Remember Baker, and this is an example. I was talking to people about this earlier. Is that Bush really had the initiative? So he immediately pointed Baker to be kind of the chair of the recount. Someone reassuring that would be trusted by the American people. As you say, he'd been Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State, and then they picked. And importantly, they also picked a lawyer, Ted Olson, to be the overall leader of the legal campaign. The Democrats did the same thing, but they did it. They lost the momentum. They were reactive and defensive. So who I bet you don't even remember who they picked to be the chairman of their campaign, their recount. Warren Christopher. Nobody remembers it was Warren Christopher. I don't even think Warren Christopher remembered it was Warren Christopher. But that gives you a sign how they were they were just reacting. They just, okay, we got to get a Secretary of State. And then they picked David Boyce. Excellent choice, great lawyer. But again, it was on the defensive. And throughout Florida 2000, the Gore camp was always reacting on the defensive to the Bush. So Bush was, not only did Bush pursue litigation in state court, he also pursued it in federal court. And he also, we can talk about this, he worked the state legislature and the role of the governor. And he had a pretty good relationship with that governor at the time. Seems how they grew up in the same house together.
A couple of questions, John, I'll let you go. Does it matter really what Donald Trump says and does if there is a legal fight in Pennsylvania? In other words, I don't see him sitting in the Oval Office and being very quiet and letting the lawyers hash things out. I expect he'll be tweeting. He may go out and do rallies and events and things like that. He'll be in the news. Do you think that would have any kind of effect on judges?
I don't think so. Now, we don't know for sure, but I think the judges will try really hard to shut their minds. That they're used to that because they often are making decisions that have important social or political consequences, and they're used to getting heaps of criticism dumped on them from one side or the other. But I do think that John Roberts, though, is different. I think he's going to be, as he's shown time, he's going to be very sensitive to the institutional reputation of the court. He's going to be very sensitive if people start attacking the court the way they did back in 2000. And he's, I think he will sometimes blur the law, not call the balls and strikes, just sort of say, he might want to call balks. I don't think he's going to get really uncomfortable. And he might actually be somebody who reacts to that kind of pressure from a Trump or a Biden. I think that might affect how he would want to try to hang back as much as possible. But he may not be able to now that Amy Coney Barrett's on the court. And, with the four justices already say they want to intervene, you've got now a fifth justice who I bet she'd want to get involved too. In the end, they don't need John Roberts' vote anymore.
Okay. And to the Democratic chorus that Coney Barrett has to recuse herself?
They've been raising this claim already. It's interesting. The justices, there's no real law that binds the justices on how they recuse or not. Ultimately, it's only up to the justices themselves. Mm-hmm. And I would think that what she would say is that as a justice of the Supreme Court, she basically said this when she was nominated and then when she was confirmed, now that I'm a justice, I am not going to look at the individuals. I'm going to look at the institutions. I'm not going to look at who, which party wins or loses or which cause wins or loses. I'm just going to call them straight on the law. And if she, I think she believes that. And I think she would then say, well, I'm going to sit on these campaign cases, just like Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are going to sit on these campaign cases, just as, Ginsburg and Breyer sat on the cases about coming out up against the Clinton administration. You're judging them based on the administration, not on the person who happens to sit in the office of the presidency.
I'm looking at Wikipedia, John, and Wikipedia, which we know never gets anything wrong, claims that, John, you grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, it is my hometown, and I am a member of the Pennsylvania Bar. I have lots of friends back in the home state. I am still keeping in touch with a lot of my friends back there, and it's just unbelievable that it's my side. I would just assume Florida is always going to screw things up. I didn't think that my home state was going to be involved.
But this is my final question. So does your eagle-clad chest swell with pride when you think of the city of Philadelphia perhaps holding the nation's future in its hands if there is a Pennsylvania challenge and is up to the city of Philadelphia to count votes and move things? Do you feel great about Philadelphia being in charge? Or are you going to go into Wikipedia and change your biography after we're done?
Oh, I love my city where I grew up. I love the Commonwealth. I still think as a Pennsylvanian, but I don't know whether it's a good idea for the fate of the nation to be in the hands of my home city. We did a pretty good job back in 1787 and 1780 with the Constitution. And we did pretty good in 1776 with the Revolution and the Declaration of Independence. But I think we might be pushing our luck to 2020.
It's analogous to a lot of Philadelphia sports teams. The city peaked a long time ago.
What are you kidding? We won the Super Bowl just a few years ago.
That was then. This is now, John. But no,
I just hope we're not. I just hope my friends back home. We better not be trying another Philly special. No more Philly specials. Play it fair and square. No funny plays. No flea flickers. No passing the ball to the quarterback on this one.
I know, but we know Chicago politics. San Francisco politics are pretty notorious as well. Florida is what Florida is. But is Philadelphia politics anything akin to this?
Oh gosh, yeah. Philadelphia politics are pretty nasty. I mean, the city they're most similar to, I always thought, is kind of like Chicago politics. It's a very, I mean, I when I grew up, Frank Rizzo was the mayor, and it was, and then it was Wilson Good, who is the mayor who you might recall dropped the bomb on the city of Philadelphia. It's been a city that has had a lot of troubles, and this is one of the favorite activities of people from Philadelphia is to bitch and moan about the idiots that they vote to put into government, and then they vote to keep them there too.
Okay. Well, be interesting if this plays out this way, and it's a shining moment for Philadelphia.
I hope so. Really. I hope so. I hope they do their jobs and don't play around. Although they're going to be tempted on both sides.
Okay, John, any last thoughts, any last words, anything you want to get in that we didn't get into?
Well, one thing we should also remember is that, yes, we're going to have all this litigation possibly, and there's a whole nother backup system to the Electoral College we shouldn't forget about, which is suppose nobody wins a majority. Suppose things get tied up in litigation. We talked about this on an earlier podcast.
Oh, you really want to go there?
No. It's just there's the 12th Amendment, and there's a whole nother backup system to the Electoral College, and maybe we'll come back and talk about that later.
Let's do a couple of minutes on the backup. Is if in mid-December the Electoral College meets, nobody gets to 270, right?
Yes. So if nobody gets a majority of the electors, then it's interesting. It could happen in two ways. It could happen because, right, the state doesn't choose to vote. It could be because there's a dispute, right, over the electors. It could be because a state like Pennsylvania, it could send two slates of electors, because suppose the vote doesn't work because it's litigated, because there's still counts and so on. The state legislature could come back and say, well, under the Constitution, we still have the right to choose electors. This was what might have happened in Florida next in 2000 if the Supreme Court hadn't intervened. And the legislature could say, we have to make sure Pennsylvania gets some votes in time. So the state legislature could say, we're going to reassume our power to pick the electors because the popular vote has failed. The governor might say, you can't do that without me. I'm going to send my own electors. This has happened before. This happened in the election of 1876. So you could have no one getting majority because there's several, you have too many electoral votes showing up in Washington. So then the 12th Amendment, interesting. It says Congress gathers right, in early January, January 3rd. And, you know, they swear in the new Congress, the one we just voted in. And then it says the vice president, in the presence of the House and Senate, opens the electoral votes. And then it says in the passive tense, the votes shall be counted. That phrase is extremely important. It has been the speculation of a lot of scholars, because we wonder, does that mean the vice president can decide which are the votes that are legitimate to count? Or does Congress decide which are the legitimate votes when you have a dispute? Say people raise objections to the votes that come out of Pennsylvania because they say, oh, there was fraud. Or they say that 3 extra days was unconstitutional. Or they say both the legislature and the president sent competing slates. The 12th Amendment doesn't actually say who decides which ones are legitimate or not. So you have that problem. And then the other problem is the one you allude to is, suppose no one gets a majority, then they can't decide. Or suppose Pennsylvania never sends any votes. Then the system switches to the backup system, which is the House of Representatives picks the president. But here again, you see the founders' deference to federalism, not popular direct election. The House votes by state delegations, where Wyoming has as one as California does, one. And so it really will be the states that will pick the president in the backup system.
I haven't done the math on the House, but I think the last time I checked, the Republicans had gained on Tuesday night 4 or 5 seats. This could change as everything gets voted. But
yes,
I don't think, John, there's going to be a shift in state delegations.
No, in fact, Republicans have gained. So again, because I watch my home state, Pennsylvania, it was 26-23 Republican before the election.
And Pennsylvania was the other.
Pennsylvania was tied. Right. And Pennsylvania actually a seat switched. So now Pennsylvania is a majority Republican delegation. So I think it's gone to 27-23.
So this is where heads explode. So under the scenario of the Democratic controlled House votes for Donald Trump for president.
Exactly. But that's what the founders wanted, right? They didn't, because if the House said, you know, by pop, you know, so you did it by individual House members, that was the actual system that they rejected. They definitely did not want the popularly elected House to choose the president under any condition. Right. So they went so far as even to say, even in the backup, we're not going to let the House members pick. We're going to make it state by state.
Right. And to close out, the Senate does it by individual member, not delegation, if it's a 51-49 Senate.
Well, here's the interesting thing. If suppose the House ties or can't make up its mind, right? There's no tiebreaker in the House, then the selection of the president would switch to the Senate, because they would be picking the vice president, and the vice president would ascend to the presidency on January 20th because the House didn't pick anyone in the end. Right. So, yeah. And as you say, Bill, the senators pick individually. Right. And so if the Republicans was it going to be 52-48, it looks like right now. So if that happens, then Michael Pence, who was the one opening the electoral ballots in the beginning of all this in the House, ends up becoming president by the election of the Senate.
And if it's a 50-50 Senate, John?
So this is really interesting. There's a much debate about this in the scholarly literature too, because it says in the Constitution, whenever the Senate is tied, Michael Pence, the vice president, would break the tie. Right. And people say, oh, it can't be that the vice president, sitting vice president, can break the tie and make himself president. That's just too much of a conflict of interest. But the Constitution seems to say that that's what happens.
Kaboom.
So, Free, if you're Mike Pence, you're going to sit there and go, oh, those 4 years of smiling and waving and never saying anything have finally paid off. Right.
So this goes back to the original question of what do lawyers do on campaigns? They end up being activated for legal challenges, and legal challenges could send us to that scenario in January 2021.
Exactly. So after that, that's when they close all the law schools and they don't let anyone practice law anymore. They said, we've had it with you guys.
That's a good question, John. If 2 months from now, if the lawyers are going to be in the basement with the pollsters.
No. We know we're always the second most hated institution, but after politicians and pollsters. Come on now.
Well done. Hey, John, I enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Bill. It's great to be with you again.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the Policy Avenue. It's available to the 45th president of the United States, that 45th right now hanging very much in balance. In this case, what to do about the election in Pennsylvania, elsewhere around the country. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the latest from Hoover's fellows. That includes John Yoo to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover, I-N-S-T, at Hoover Inst. John Yoo is not on Twitter, so don't go onto Twitter and look for the many John Yoos who are not the John Yoo. He is not to be found, but you can hear him on Hoover's Pacific Century podcast, as well as his podcast and sometimes policy briefings that we do for Hoover. And, of course, his book you can get on Amazon. It's a really wonderful read, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.